Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, our Bangkok correspondent updates us on the Thai bombing that left 20 people dead. We consider what's behind the rise of ISIS in the Middle East. We speak with the author of a new book on violence among youth.
There are many causes of violence, and part of the problem is that we see violence as an overarching problem when in fact it's a thousand different problems.
And a jazz artist continues his reign atop the music charts. It's ahead on The Voice of America. Thousands of dwellings in Bangkok are being searched for clues in the bombing of a popular shrine 1 week ago. Our correspondent Steve Herman has been on this story from the very moment it began and joins us on the line. Welcome, Steve.
Hi, Susan.
Hi. First of all, what can you tell us about this investigation?
Well, what's happening now is the police are saying that they have more than 10,000 places in Bangkok that they need to inspect and search. And this is part of an operation that was announced a day or two ago where they've mobilized 1,000 police officers and soldiers and municipal government workers, sort of a crackdown on crime and to try to make some progress in the investigation. And it's mainly seen as trying to boost public confidence in the investigation and reassure tourists that Thailand is safe.
Now, I read that some of the guest houses frequented by foreigners are also being searched. Why is this?
Well, they believe that these are the types of places that those involved in the bombing presumably would have been staying at, that they're not expecting that they were necessarily staying in the five-star hotels or that they were a long-time residents, but also some condominiums are being searched as well.
Now, you alluded to this, but Thailand's police force and its military-led government have gotten some criticism in this investigation. Can you tell us about that?
Oh, absolutely. There's been contradictions day to day, just a lot of releases of information that really didn't seem to make sense. They're criticized, of course, for a lack of progress because there's no clue except for this guy in the yellow shirt with the backpack who was seen going to and leaving the package at the shrine shortly before the bombing and then walking down the street and getting into a tuk-tuk. Also, they're perceived as having misplaced priorities, and they've arrested two Thais for spreading rumors on social media about the investigation, and the latest is a Hong Kong photographer has now been arrested as he was boarding an airplane to leave Bangkok because he was carrying an armored vest and a helmet, which is standard operating equipment for most correspondents and photographers when they come here because things can get violent on the streets of Bangkok.
And I understand the police have complained about technology, a lack of that.
Yes, again, before they were saying they had it all under control. They could do this investigation on their own. They rebuffed the offers of help from other countries. And now the national police chief is saying, well, we really could use some cooperation from the international community. Other countries have these biometric systems that we don't happen to have in Thailand, and we could really use some help. So, you know, these types of contradictions and statements don't instill a tremendous amount of confidence in the investigation when you're comparing it to international standards.
You were an eyewitness to this, and as I remember, you actually heard the explosion. Could you take
right.
us back to that day and tell us what you heard and saw?
Well, I was here in the VOA Bureau, which is on the 15th floor of an office building, probably less or about a kilometer away from the blast, and at first I heard it. I heard something, and I thought it was thunder. It was an odd sort of boom, but the only type of boom that I had heard before that wasn't thunder that was like that was when I was in Kabul in Afghanistan when there would be some larger-scale explosions. And I thought, well, we really don't have those types of explosions in Thailand, and that we had a long period of political calm. And then I thought, well, maybe there's a warehouse or something that blew up. And then it became evident that something was amiss, and our videographer and myself quickly hustled ourselves up Ratchadamri Boulevard to get to the site. And even when we were within, I guess, about 150 meters, we could smell explosives, and we knew definitely at that point that it wasn't, you know, like a transformer exploding or anything like that. And then when we got on the scene immediately and got right to the fence of the shrine, we could see the bodies inside the shrine and as well as outside the shrine.
This was quite a shock to the nation.
It's unprecedented. Although there's been bombings and all sorts of political violence and many, many coups in Thailand over the decades, and there are explosions that happen all the time in the far south where you have separatist groups along the border with Malaysia, there's never been anything of this magnitude in Bangkok. So, yes, people were quite stunned by it, and still people are nervous because there's been no claim of responsibility. We don't know who did this or why.
Well, thank you very much for speaking with us today, Steve.
My pleasure, Susan.
Joining me here in the studio is reporter Andrew Palchevsky with a look at what is being said today in social media. So, Andrew, what's going on?
Well, the big trending topic this morning is also out of Asia, hashtag Black Monday. Stocks across Asia are plummeting, and this is having a ripple effect across the globe into Europe and into the U.S. The U.S. markets are forecast to have one of their worst days in the past 4 or 5 years.
Yeah,
futures are already down, I think, 600 points on the Dow.
Just look at my retirement fund and weep.
Well, that's the thing that a lot of people are saying. I saw, actually, our own Cal Perry said that, sorry to say, your 401k is now a 4.01k.
Yeah.
And a lot of people are saying, you know, one person said, you don't know how bad it's going to be, or you know how bad it's going to be when you see hashtag Black Monday trending in the U.S. as the top topic and the markets haven't even opened yet.
Yeah.
So a lot of people worried about that. One person said it's a good day to own nothing, so taking some positivity out of that. Another big top trending story today, the Legion of Honor. Of course, over the weekend, three Americans and one Briton stopped a gunman on a train traveling between Paris and Amsterdam. They received the Legion of Honor this morning from France's president. It's the highest honor. Twitter, of course, calling them heroes, courageous, very lucky as well. And I saw a tweet that I really liked that said, who needs superheroes? Just put these three guys in the next Hollywood blockbuster. It'll be a lot more entertaining,
yes,
a lot more fun.
Yes, and Obama even gave him a call and congratulated him.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's a feel-good story for sure, and that's something else people have been pointing out in a time when we're talking a lot about terror and, you know, down markets and things like that. It's nice to have a good feel-good story. And then today in the U.S., finally, we have a happy first day of school. Millions of school children across the U.S. going back for the new school year. People saying congratulations to the parents, condolences to the teachers. And I thought it was interesting. All these schools are going on posting pictures of the kids coming back on Twitter. And I was thinking, I did not have my school did not have Twitter when I was in school because Twitter didn't exist. So it's a new way to communicate with students and parents. So it's great to see all those kids going back to school. Maybe not great for them, but like we said, great for the parents and great for the U.S.
Okay, well, thank you, Andrew. I appreciate you stopping by.
Thank you.
And this is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
The 1980s saw an increase in the number of women who joined their spouses in the workforce. With both parents working and unable to stay at home to care for their children, many of these families had to turn to daycare. As more and more children were enrolled at these facilities, childcare experts expressed concern and started to warn parents about potential harmful effects that daycare could have on a child. This, of course, left the working parent with feelings of guilt and anxiousness. A new study recently published in Psychological Science should bring a measure of relief to those who send their children to daycare. Researchers followed 1,000 Norwegian kids who were sent to childcare facilities and found that the amount of time they spent at daycare had very little to do with aggressive behavior. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
The Islamic State group's claim to be an Islamic caliphate has raised concerns that its ambitions to capture and administer territory have no geographic limits. Militants in Egypt, Libya, Nigeria, Pakistan, and Afghanistan have taken up the Islamic State's trappings and sworn allegiance to its leader, Baghdadi. Some critics in Washington argue that insufficient support for rebel forces in Syria with training and arms from the U.S. contributed to the rise of the terrorist group. International Edition's Mohamed El-Shenawy spoke with Ambassador Alberto Fernandez, former coordinator of the State Department's Center for Strategic Counterterrorism Communications, about the rise of the Islamic State group and how to counter its propaganda. Welcome, Mohamed. What was the main reason Ambassador Fernandez cited behind the emergence of this group?
Well, Susan, he mentioned several causes, starting with the U.S. invasion of Iraq, the U.S. inaction toward the Syrian crisis, the economic grievances in the Middle East, and political exclusion, among other factors.
After the Arab Spring, you had weakened states, you had anarchy develop in Syria, and you had a dysfunctional, incompetent government in Iraq. So there was a vacuum. There was an ungoverned space that the Islamic State sought to fill. And so you basically, the implosion that happened in Syria and the implosion that happened, the vacuum that was created in Iraq by the terrible mistakes of the Maliki government gave a tremendous opportunity for these extremists to put their ideas, their takfiri, Salafi, jihadi ideas into effect.
Susan, according to Ambassador Fernandez, that is the same approach Al-Qaeda adopted in other places like northern Mali, Somalia, parts of Yemen, and in northern Nigeria.
Mohamed, but President Obama said the international community needs to address grievances that terrorists exploit, including economic and political issues.
Well, Ambassador Fernandez acknowledged that dealing with the rise of the Islamic State should be a multi-pronged approach, not only in the battlefield. He said it should include better governance, dealing with the socio-economic grievances, deconstructing the hateful ideology of ISIS, opening the political space, and avoiding painting all Islamists with one broad brush as violent extremists.
Yeah, it's very dangerous because it won't drive everyone into the ranks of the Islamic State, but it will encourage people to go there. Because if you're accused of being something that you're not, you might as well do it, right? No, this is the problem. The question of political Islam, of the role of Islam expressed in a political world, we have to find a way to do that.
Ambassador Fernandez argued that you can physically crush a group of fighters belonging to ISIS, but if the reasons behind their ideology and if the appeal to join the Islamic State continued, then you did not solve any problem.
Mohamed, thank you for this analysis, and I understand we will have more about this interview on how to fight back ISIS propaganda.
Sure, Susan. There is more to come.
Coming up on International Edition, a look at rising violence among the young and the continued success of one jazz artist. Violence among young people seems to be getting worse in the U.S. and elsewhere, but what can be done about it? Author Jan Arno considers youth violence in her latest book, In the Line of Fire, Raising Kids in a Violent World, and she joins us now on the line. Welcome, Jan.
Good morning.
What is the cause of the violence?
There are many causes of violence, and part of the problem is that we see violence as an overarching problem when, in fact, it's a thousand different problems. It's as if a doctor would say to you, oh, you have an illness, and then walk away. And, of course, if you don't know what he's talking about, what kind of illness, you wouldn't know what to do about it. But if someone said, oh, you have a ductal type 2 tumor, and it's in this place, and it's this big, and, you know, you would know that possibly that was breast cancer, and you would know what to do about it.
Can you give us some as an example?
Yes. The earliest kind of violence, I believe, and it's sometimes difficult to understand from adult perspectives, is when we read children and allow children to read early childhood literature that is racist and sexist. And I note in my book many different kinds of literature, many different titles that when read by a child or to a child is from the arms of a caregiver, the child takes that as the gospel truth. And when we are raising children who are not able to get along with people who are different from them, that creates a problem. we go on from there into video games and allowing children free range of video games. The more violent, the better, because that's what holds their attention. And that moves right along into school, where we get bullying on the playground and in the classroom, and into further into community violence, neighborhood violence, domestic violence. There are so many different types of violence that it's really difficult to pinpoint. As far as where it comes from many places. We have a biological, small biological factor of violence. Kids are not born to hate and to be violent. They learn it, but then there are some children who are more prone to it than others. We have the family situation where if a child sees the parents screaming at each other or father bullying the mother, then that's what the child learns to do. That's what the child feels is normal. We see all kinds of things on television these days, not just the fiction, the programs that we see, but also in the news. We have small children watching the news, wondering if their school is going to be bombed or if their neighborhood is going to have a school shooter around. And it goes on from there all the way through to hate crime in the community.
Thank you, Jan. Jan Arno, author of In the Line of Fire, Raising Kids in a Violent World. This is VOA.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondence, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day, wherever the news may be. Our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondence, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Hashtag VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at hashtag VOA. You can reach me at Twitter, at Perry Cal, or talk to the show anytime. Please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked. We love to be seen. And you can reach us anytime.
One of the biggest jazz artists among Asian audiences continues his reign atop the music charts. We hear more from International Edition colleague Steve Norman.
Do you recognize that sound? That's right, it's jazz saxophonist Kenny G, who by most standards is the biggest-selling instrumental musician and one of the best-selling artists of all time. Girl from Ipanema is off his recently released album, Brazilian Nights. The 58-year-old sold more than 75 million records since 1973. When still in high school, he started his career in music, playing sax in Barry White's Love Unlimited Orchestra. Kenny G's first solo album came out in 1982 with a rapid succession of dozens of records over the years and numerous singles, including Songbird. When released in 1987, it became the first instrumental to reach the top 40 of the Billboard Hot 100. We'll be right back. Kenny G was an instant success. His tours worldwide were sold out, and he became one of the highest paid performers of all time. Silhouette followed Songbird as Kenny G's next hit single, reaching number one on the contemporary jazz chart.
We would like to invite you to follow us on Twitter. You can find us at VOA_IE. If you'd like to listen to today's program again, you're welcome to. Just visit our website at voanews.com. Go to the Programs tab in the upper right-hand corner, then scroll down to International Edition. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
After another delay, South Sudan President Salva Kiir appears ready to finally sign the peace agreement negotiated with the help of regional leaders in Addis Ababa. It is a hopeful sign that an end may be near for the crippling factional fighting that has roiled the East African nation for 20 months. On August 17th, the deadline for formalizing the agreement, hammered out in talks sponsored by the Intergovernmental Agency on Development, or IGAD, President Kiir announced that he still had reservations about some aspects of the agreement and wanted 15 more days of consultations with his government before returning to Addis Ababa to sign it. Opposition leader Riek Machar and other parties and stakeholders had signed the agreement, however, leaving many frustrated over the continued struggle. Untold numbers of people have been killed, and more than 2 million have been displaced since fighting broke out in December 2013, when a political dispute between the president and Machar, his former vice president, escalated into intercommunal conflict. Even now, the fighting continues as government troops attacked rebel positions in Imatong hours after Kiir requested more time to consider the deal. 2 days later, however, as the United Nations was considering further steps to discourage fighting and emphasize the need to finalize the agreement, including the establishment of an international arms embargo, President Kiir called U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry to say that his concerns had been addressed, and he plans to add his name to the agreement. The United States has welcomed the signing of this agreement by the opposition leader and other key groups, and we urge the government of South Sudan to follow through on its pledge to formalize the deal, which has been agreed to and supported by not only the IGAD states, but also the United Kingdom, Norway, China, the African Union, and United Nations. The United States will continue to consult with international partners on how best to take action against anyone undermining the peace process. President Obama made clear that there will be a price to pay for that intransigence. It's time to sign this agreement and to move forward for the South Sudanese people.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.